Dave Garraway here. Still transcribed so clear you can hear every word, I hope, if it's clear where you are. But if anyone told you that for the next hour you'd be hearing from drummer Gene Krupa and the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, as well as one of the nation's noted clergymen, as well as the greatest living classical scholar in the world today, well, you might be prompted to observe there's a crazy mixed-up radio program. And honestly, I don't think we're mixed up at all. We may be crazy, but I don't think we're mixed up. We aim to ask all you Gene Krupa fans to dig some atomic jive with us. And all you H-bomb fans... That's a frightening phrase, isn't it? I wonder if there are any. Well, we want you to dig old Gene, if there are any. Because way down deep, we believe that good talk about important matters with people who are qualified to make the good talk is just as entertaining and as lively and as mellow and as crazy, as they say, in the music business as a matinee at Birdland. Remember how last week we talked with philosopher Bertrand Russell about how to keep your head in the age of the H-bomb? Among other things, he told us that he believed that survival was a mutual matter. If you wanted to, then you had to let the other fellow survive too. And the stakes, said Mr. Russell, are no more or no less than the survival of all mankind. As we promised tonight, we're going to talk about those high stakes with some other distinguished company. From Oxford, England, we'll be speaking with the great classical scholar Gilbert Murray. Dr. Gilbert Murray. But first, from Washington, let us call in a well-known Unitarian clergyman, Dr. A. Powell Davies of the All Souls Church. Dr. Davies is a frequent contributor to national magazines and an outspoken essayist on many issues of the day. And Dr. Davies, I'd like to throw the same set of questions at you that I asked Bertrand Russell last week. The first one is this. Do you think that the great new weapons of destruction, such as the H-bomb, bring man closer to peace or to war?
Well, I think it depends upon mankind. I don't think the size of the weapon would be determinative, but I should think that since the dimensions of disaster, of possible disaster, have grown so much greater, the fear of war and the desire to avoid it would have grown very much greater too. There would be more likelihood, I would think, that mankind would want to avoid war than be drawn into it.
I've heard it said, and I bet you have too, that man contains within himself seeds of his own destruction. That is, by his nature, he tends to destroy everything, including himself, and that never until now has he had the tools to do this, but with the H-bomb, he will. Do you believe this?
No, I don't. I don't think that mankind is foredoomed or predestined to destroy himself. There's good and there's evil, and he's always been able to choose between them. It's perfectly true that mankind has done very destructive things, but it's also true that the whole of civilization is testimony to mankind's possibility for good. Mm-hmm. I think there is free will, there is choice, and mankind is able to decide his own destiny.
Do you see any danger in attempted world domination by a single nation through the use of this weapon?
Well, yes, I think through the threat of it, it's entirely possible. Any nation that achieved some extraordinary technical advance might be able to threaten other nations, or through conspiracy, some one nation might achieve world domination. I think we have to be alert to that possibility and provide democratic forms of world organization to avoid any possibility of, well, to avoid the fact of a tyrannical world domination.
You think we've gone too fast? Do you think that our scientific knowledge has outdistanced our capacity to control it?
No. It's perfectly true that physical science is far in advance of the social sciences, and man is emotionally immature, and intellectually he's able to solve these immense physical problems. Mm-hmm. I would be very much happier if we'd had more time to grow morally and spiritually before we'd achieve these immense powers over nature.
Mm-hmm. What caused our infantilism emotionally and culturally compared to our scientific age?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. I think we have to concede that there are things in the processes of history which are not plain to us. But the one thing I believe that is plain is that Man refuses to do the right that he can do, to follow the good that he knows, and in that way keeps himself morally crippled.
Is there any possibility that his very nature, the nature of, say, his nervous system, of his makeup physiologically, may force him into this pattern forever?
No, I don't believe so. Mankind must have had many mutations, changes, advances in the past, and we're not to suppose that those are ruled out for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, it would require an immense advance to bring us to the moral and spiritual maturity that would make us equal to our present problems.
What a delightful thought, though, if we were able to do that someday.
Yes. Well, I think someday we will, or our successors.
Uh-huh. How beautiful we will be then. Doctor, if you had your choice of what era in which to be born, would you choose the present one or some past one?
Well, I think it would have to be the present one. I think each of us, of course, is so conditioned by his own time that he's hardly able to give an objective answer to that question. Mm-hmm. If it were not this, then I think I would choose 5th century Greece, Athens.
Mm-hmm. Your reference to Greece is especially apt, Doctor, because Gilbert Murray is going to be on this very show with you this evening.
Oh, that's marvelous. I'm a great admirer of his.
I imagine he'd choose about the same century in the same place.
It'd be interesting to find out, yes.
I'd like to come with you. If you're going, let me know.
Well, I'd love to have you come.
How do you think the individual can best maintain some poise and equanimity in the hydrogen age?
Well, I think that one thing that's necessary is that he should face the facts. I'm not sure that we've been given information enough to enable us to face the facts as we should.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that knowledge is repressed, then it wreaks its own vengeance upon you. You refer to the nervous system. I think it even does it with that. I think a lot of people do have repressed anxieties.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you know what you have to face, no matter what it is, you're a great deal better off. And next, I think that knowing what you're facing, you must have a realistic program and an adequate program for dealing with it. And I don't think that's merely a military program. I think the military program is necessary, but I think we should see the world needs 2 billion people on this earth, and neither Russians nor Americans, and many of them are destitute and chronically famine-stricken. If we had a program for the pacification of the world and for world security, I think we would feel that we had something constructive that might solve our problem. Beyond that, I think we should try to do normal things. If we have an adequate program, we think we're doing all we can, then to live as nearly as we can a normal life. And from the standpoint of religion, I think it's important for people not to expect God to do for them what they're well able to do for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a prayer meeting is a good thing, but it's not a substitute for a correct foreign policy.
Well, thank you very much again, Dr. Davies. You've set us to thinking, and that's a good thing on a Sunday night or any other time. On the other end of this line in Washington, you've been hearing the pastor of All Souls Unitarian Church in the national capital, Dr. A. Powell Davies. I've put to him a set of questions about man's fate in these times, questions that we'll be putting to other clergymen and philosophers, psychologists, many people as the weeks go on. And by the way, how are Eugene Cooper cats holding up? You digging this? Stay with it, because you're going to need it, I think. And Gene's coming, too. And now, I feel a tremendous sense of privilege, really, to be able to talk to Professor Gilbert Murray, who is at the other end of this transatlantic circuit in Oxford, England, in his study. Dr. Gilbert Murray's name is, to face it abruptly, is not a household word, unless your household happens to be knee-deep in classical studies. But this is a man to know. He was born in 1866, and through most of the 88 years of his life, he has lived on most intimate terms with one of the great civilizations in history. Gilbert Murray is one of the great Greek scholars, whose translations, in fact, of Greek drama and literature are part of the treasure that we call our own civilization. Perspective is one of the words that we use or misuse again and again, and what we call perspective is all too often a very short view indeed. But from the richness of Dr. Gilbert Murray's scholarship and from his intimacy with the great era of man's past, I think we can gain some wisdom which can really be called perspective. As I mentioned, Dr. Murray is in his study in Oxford, England, and through our transatlantic circuit, we're able to talk to him right now. Dr. Murray, if you've been able to eavesdrop on our program for the last few minutes, you know that we've been talking about various problems of man in this atomic age. Let me ask you, sir, if you feel that the H-bomb brings us closer to peace or to war.
Well, on the whole, I think to peace. Especially taken in connection with the experience of the recent awful wars. No one makes war unless he expects to win. Indeed, no one makes war unless he expects to win pretty easily and quickly. Just look back. The Kaiser in 1914 spoke of having a frischer, fröhlicher Krieg, a fresh, joyous war, and of having it all over before the leaves came in spring. He had 4 years and then an awful defeat. Hitler made certain a victory, and he did conquer nearly all Europe in the first 6 months. And then, a worse defeat than ever, absolute ruin. Well, you know, even we, when we started the South African War, used to say that the troops would be back by Christmas. But we had a bad time of it, and it took us over 3 years. So that all the people who've made war recently have found war a far worse and more exhausting experience than they imagined. There's no chance of a safe and easy war.
Yes, history has certainly proved that, Dr. Murray. But about man himself, is man a basic problem? Do you think that he will destroy himself?
No, I don't. I think to speak of man as a unit is misleading. I think there's a remote possibility that a band of criminals or lunatics or a nation of utter barbarians might somehow get hold of this weapon or some other weapon and destroy the civilized world. And they might then destroy themselves too. But I think, Mr. Galloway, that's all exceedingly unlikely. And I don't think it's in the nature of man to do it.
Well, Dr. Murray, what about that area of life which we might call accidental? For example, could this destruction be brought about or set off by, say, some little wars?
Yes, it might. That's one of the great dangers. And I think that's one of the dangers of the Cold War. That if you go on having little wars here and there, at any moment, rather by accident, they may turn into the big war.
Or could it be put this way, maybe? That man might not destroy himself, but men might destroy man.
I think that's just conceivable, but not really probable.
Well, we all want to believe that, I'm sure. And that leads me to ask you whether or not you see in the hydrogen bomb the possibility of world domination by a single nation.
Not particularly through this weapon, but there's always been that danger. Many conquerors have aimed at world power, and both Nazi Germany and have done so, and Russia is doing so now. Not to speak of Napoleon and Alexander the Great and the rest of them. But the real special danger there comes from the fact that almost everyone is agreed, the world is making towards some ultimate unity. Well, now, will it be a unity of organized agreement of free nations like the United Nations, or a unity of conquest by one great power? Well, we've had enough disappointments over the League of Nations and the United Nations, but in spite of all our disappointments, I think a United Nations of some kind is the most likely. I don't see the United States breaking out as a lawless world conqueror. Russia plus China is enormously strong. It might do it. Might for a time win. But then they couldn't stay united. The unity would break down. And we'd have to begin the struggle over again. I think some sort of organized United Nations is the most likely.
Dr. Murray, a lot of people have been saying that science has outdistanced man's capacity to deal with his discoveries. Would you agree to that proposition?
I don't think so. I think something that Bernard Shaw said at the beginning of this century is probably true, that man remains of the same stature, but that the problems, the international and world problems, man has before him are bigger and more difficult. A little bit ago, European nations had practically only to think about Europe. Now every nation's got to think about Asia and Africa and all sorts of places. And we've got all our social problems as well.
The mind of man, then, is equal to his new weapons and powers, hmm?
I think he can deal with the particular difficulty of his destructive weapons. I always think that primitive man's discovery of fire must have been the most alarming discovery ever made. When he'd got a thing that would sweep through forests and destroy everything. He's had lots of new destructive weapons since then. I think he ought to be able to manage them.
Well, Dr. Murray, we've been asking our noted guests in this part of our program whether or not they'd care to be born again in these times. At age 88, what would you say?
It's awfully difficult to say, because you know your own age intimately, and you have only the vaguest notion of what any other age would have been like. I think this is a very interesting time, though a time of great suffering. On the whole, I feel pretty sure that Europe as a whole was a much happier and more law-abiding place before 1914. It's been corrupted by wars and occupations and mass cruelties and the like. The suffering has been frightful. But this particular country, I think, though one hesitates to say it, I think has been rather ennobled than demoralized by the wars. We have very steadily resisted the oppressors, and like the United States, we've given generous help to the afflicted and oppressed. One man that I'm thinking of, a Polish refugee, told me how after horrible sufferings in one country after another, he got to Liverpool. There he thought he was safe, but he felt a heavy hand on his shoulder and looked up. And there was a policeman who said, if you go through that door, you'll get a nice cup of tea. Well, that's a great record. And we've sought no increase of power or territory. I think it'll be a great loss to the world if the British Commonwealth continues to lose power and influence. To save, we've got a great civilization to save, and I think we can save it.
And it's a civilization, Doctor, which through your own studies of ancient Greece you can judge from a very special point of view. These times and those times are closely related, I think, in many ways. What's the way by which we can keep our poise today?
Well, Mr. Garraway, I think the main thing is just to preserve and carry further the great principles of Christian, or as I should call it, Hellenic, that is Greek, civilization, which we're all accustomed to. There are many forces tending to re-barbarize the world. We must not let ourselves be barbarized. It means a higher standard of duty in citizens and statesmen, a recognition that law is above man and not man above law. And I think it implies also what we've very much got and what the Greeks in the later age were devoted to. First of all, a wish for concord between the nations and ultimately the making of the world into one great city, as they called it, one great city of men and gods. That's what we're all working for.
Yes, indeed. Well, Dr. Murray, these several thousand miles between your microphone and mine and your study in Oxford and myself in New York have seemed like a very short distance tonight. Our great thanks to you, sir. We've tried to ask some big questions, but whether we managed that or not, we certainly did get some big answers. Good night, sir, and our best wishes for many more years. We've been talking, of course, to the famous scholar, Dr. Gilbert Murray, whose studies of ancient times allows him to see these times through a perspective of many centuries. To get back to these times, do you know how much our atomic energy program costs in terms of dollars? Well, to date, the figure is $11 billion. And important dollars. As Admiral Louis Strauss, the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, pointed out late this week, Chairman Strauss is not a man who makes many speeches, but his job with the AEC lends importance to his words when he does speak. And this week, he told us some of the things that our $11 billion has bought.
It is true that the taxpayer has put up $11 billion thus far, but the American people now own a vast industrial complex which at today's replacement value is probably worth in excess of its cost. And the major product which has been produced, that is to say the fissionable material that is in the atomic weapons, can be just as well used for power if it is ever safe to do so. Safe, that is, in the international political sense. Incidentally, it is not a perishable material. Viewed in this light, therefore, we have used our $11 billion to build a capital plant to stockpile uranium-235, plutonium, and other special materials as enormous reserves which may ultimately return their cost to us, and perhaps far more than their cost, in the production of economical electrical energy. Now, it would be misleading also to assume that the atomic energy program involves a cost represented by the expenditure of money alone. It is the demands of this program for electrical energy, for critical materials, and for highly trained and specialized manpower that have had the greatest impact on the economy of our country by taking material and men out of other pursuits. It appears, for example, that by the end of this year, our atomic program will be using about 10% of all the electricity made in the United States. It already uses more than 7% of all the nickel produced, more than 20% of all the stainless steel, and I could go on naming other materials. The program also absorbs the services of some 14,000 technically trained individuals, mostly scientists and engineers. And our recruitment program, unfortunately, is in constant competition with that of private industry. So that is the reason that I say that the impact of atomic energy on our economy cannot be measured in terms of dollars alone. In sum, the atom has been and continues to be a greedy consumer of electrical power at a time when the utilities are struggling to keep abreast of civilian demand. It consumes critical materials that could be used in civilian production. It slices deep into the limited supply of specialized manpower. And this is a brief summary of what the atomic program takes out of the economy. Now, it is reassuring to turn to an evaluation of what the atom is putting into the economy. Paramount, of course, is its contribution to peace and security. And who can put a price on that? It is our fervent hope in America that in our atomic strength there is also approach to the kind of peace which is our ultimate objective, a peace based on good deeds and mutual trust, if that can ever be attained. There have been one or two hopeful, uncertain signs of late that the destructive potentials of atomic war on all antagonists is a thought that is penetrating hitherto obstinate ears. We hope that the Soviets are recognizing what we have long known, that if there is ever a future atomic war, the whole world will pay an awesome price. However, without borrowing any credit from an uncertain future, we may be justified in feeling that the contribution of the atom to the security of free men thus far has repaid us for the sacrifices and economic strains that the program may have necessitated thus far. But this is by no means the only benefit that we have received. The list of dividends is long, and there is only time to give it an outline.
And Admiral Strauss listed basic research, medical benefits, industrial power, new frontiers in agriculture, things like that, as just a few of the peacetime benefits that are offered by the atom. And he spoke of the promise for all men if this great force can be turned to peaceful uses. An idea advanced by President Eisenhower when he proposed the International Atom Bank to serve these peaceful ends.
In seeking a solution to the economic development of nuclear power, we have but to explore further into natural laws and apply them to our needs. In these areas, involving as they do inanimate nature, we know that we can make progress. The other problem is not so simple, since the obstacles are in human nature. The success or failure of our attempts, therefore, to establish international cooperation in atomic energy may be coincident with the progress or the retreat of civilization. with a demonstration of what the atom can accomplish for man's good, the pleas of the disease and famine-ridden peoples and of nations hungry for power sources to energize their economies and elevate their standards of living may well become increasingly insistent even beyond the Iron Curtain. If only on a limited scale, the peoples of the world are allowed to glimpse the atom at work for humanity, vistas of peace and prosperity will be open for them. And once seen, it will be increasingly difficult even for a tyrannical political system to deny them these benefits.
The chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, Louis L. Strauss, speaking this week, and a thrilling promise of the good things that can come if man can learn to handle and live with this power from the sun that is now his. I wonder how many of those Gene Krupa fans we've held on to in the last 20-odd minutes. Quite a few, I'll bet, because those live ones have to dig this atom jazz just as you or I, or they're just kidding themselves. Well, we won't kid any more about Brother Krupa. In a moment, we're going to pay a visit to his new school of drumming in the interests of our own personal advancement. Meanwhile, shall we not hear the great man and his sextet? Is Carnation Hop. And this is the moment for that soul searching which is called station identification. Who am I? Where am I? What time is it? There are answers to these searching questions, friends, and I know a man who has them. He is not transcribed, although I am. But this shall not come between us, shall it?
Gonna take a sentimental journey. Gonna set my heart at ease. Gonna make a sentimental journey to renew old memories. Got my bag, I got my reservation. Spent each dime I could afford. Child in wild anticipation, long to hear that all aboard. Seven, that's the time we live at seven. I'll be waiting up for heaven.
This is Sunday with Garraway. This is the NBC Radio Network.
This gentle percussion, which I hope is soothing all our ears, comes from the drums of the old master, Gene Krupa. And a scholarly gent is Gene these days, because with another great drummer, Cozy Cole, Gene has taken over some premises on West 54th Street here in New York and opened himself up a school of percussion. It may not be Juilliard, but it's really solid, I can tell you. A drummer, you know, finds his music very relaxing, even though maybe nobody else does. I can state this authoritatively because I'm a drummer. in my way, and this, friends, is why I've come tonight to the Cozy Cold Gene Krupa Drum School. And as they say, here comes Gene Krupa now.
I heard you play the other night, Dave. Over at Basin Street, you sat in for a number. Slim got you up. And while I was pleasantly surprised, I think there's room for a little improvement, so I suggest you take a lesson.
Well, Gene, I didn't really think I needed a lesson. I really just dropped by to visit and to listen. Look, I've been drumming man and boy for 9 to 3 months now. I touch the skins with a very fine feeling, boy. My brushwork is delicate, soothing. You really think a few lessons might help me?
Well, Dave, why all this interest in drums? Why do you want to be a drummer?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that question. Frankly, I don't know. But you know how it is with business. Television and radio could blow over. And, of course, I keep getting invited to parties when I tell them I'll bring the drums. You know how it is.
But Dave, I don't dig. I mean, you sing so well, and you're doing so well, and you're so interested in your cars, you drive so well, I don't dig. Why do you want a drum?
Well, it's just something deep inside of me, like the beat, beat, beat of the tom-tom when the evening shadows fall, as the song goes. Or is it the tick, tick, tick of the old clock as it hangs upon the wall? Or, no, it's the drip, drip, drip of the raindrop. Well, Cole Port will forgive us all. I don't know, I just have to drum. Because there's one terrible problem, and that's the noise. Because you can't really practice at home. If you do, the neighbors get with the gendarmes pretty soon.
Oh, well, Dave, we got a cure for that. Here's what we call a practice pad. And I thank goodness for the practice pad. I guess it's about the only way we can stay in business. It makes far less noise than the drum, you see, because here, I'm going to beat it pretty hard now, and you see, no one gets hurt too much. Here we go. I'll make a simple little flourish before a paradiddle.
You could do good anywhere with that pad, couldn't you? Give us another little touch there, will you, Gene? Maybe you could demonstrate some of the finer shades. For example, give us a paradiddle. How is a paradiddle made?
That is made this way. A stroke with the right hand, a tap with the left hand, two taps with the right hand. Now we turn that right around. We make a stroke with the left, a tap with the right, and two taps with the left. Now, in the old days, Dave, the old masters, the old drum masters, guys like Sanford Moeller, my teacher, Roy Knapp, George Lawrence Stone, all the real drum greats, they advocated starting the paradiddle slow, very slowly, and accelerating. And even when I studied with those guys, I used to argue with them about it, because I maintained that if you learn to play a certain beat and accelerate it gradually, then when you try to play that same beat as you were playing in a group or in an orchestra or in a band, well, maybe that force of habit would assert itself, and there you would be racing the tempo. And, of course, the main thing in all percussion is to keep a pretty steady tempo. So I tried to cure that situation by teaching the kids to play a paradiddle very slowly, but tapping the foot in, say, quarter notes, like this. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. Now, keeping the same beat, that four, with the foot, will graduate from quarter notes into eighths and into sixteenths and then maybe into 30 seconds. And let's try it. Here we go. Three, four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four.
Here, let me try that. The beat's around here someplace. I seem to have misplaced it for the moment.
Well, Dave, looks like I started you out a little bit too far ahead. So let's go back to a more basic beat. I mean, let's go back to where all rhythm was originated, the Belgian Congo. You see, Dave, the reason I played this Belgian Congo music, I think it'll help you a lot, because what I got from it was an idea for a record which Benny Goodman made in about 1936 or 1937 called Sing, Sing, Sing. And if anyone were to ask me what one particular record did you the most good, I would say Sing, Sing, Sing. Thank you.
That, need I tell you, was Sing, Sing, Sing. The original was recorded by the Benny Goodman Band on that warm July 6th in 1937. Jess Stacy's two fine piano hands and Ziggy's trumpet, and Harry James was in the band, too, then. About $80 a week, I think. And Benny and our guest tonight, Gene Krupp, were playing drums, of course. And not only very instructive, but great fun to hear. Gene, I can't play the conga drums at home, so let's get back to the practice pad. I don't think we've described a practice pad for the folks.
It's a piece of wood, as you can see, and of course it's slanted like a drum would be as you played it. And mounted on this piece of wood is a rubber, which of course allows the student to hear what he's doing, but doesn't disturb Mom or Pop or the neighbors.
I ought to explain to Mom and Pop that if that practice pad sounds rather loud to the ear on the radio here, it's only because the microphone is very close to it, mighty close. Say, have you ever noticed that those people who work off their nerves by thumping their fingers on a desk, say? In fact, now that I think of it, Gene, your practice pad is more than an aid to would-be drummers. Man, this has great possibilities. This is a therapeutic delight here for nervous executives. I could hear it now. Two paradiddles and a rat-a-tat-tat for the ulcered executive. Like the beat, beat, beat of the whatchamacallit. Gene, why don't you try that?
A paradiddle for the busy executive?
There now, I bet we've set the business community back some 26 years or so. A drum sonata for a nervous executive. And Dr. Krupa, this visit to your new drum school has been, shall we say, both educational and inspiring. In fact, we have. But before I go, let me ask you a last question. Gene, honestly, do you think I really have any talent for the drums?
Do you want an honest answer?
Yeah.
Thanks, Dave. It's been mighty nice chatting with you.
Goodbye, Gene. And thanks for your honest opinion. And it's been, if not swell, even better to have you come by. I guess I'll have to change my plans, though. I wonder, how many harmonicas can you trade in on a set of Slingerlands?
Mm-hmm.
That was Gene Krupa and his sextet, and somewhat quieter than you expected, I'll bet you. Lovely thing called paradise. And now, right before the news, here's the same sextet and something you might have expected from Krupa and company, called Overtime. Time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things. And this is old Dave Walrus speaking. And how are you? Guess we must have latched onto an old Ben Burney script tonight. But the time has come, my friend, for a substantial review of the day's news, including those ever-loving baseball scores tonight. And a substantial citizen from NBC News here is here to give you all the details. He's Jim Fleming.
Well, Dave, the situation grows more desperate at Dien Bien Phu in Indochina. The rebel shock troops have poured through three defense posts, occupied part of a fourth. The latest dispatch says that it seems far from realistic to expect the defenders to beat off the charging enemy thousands hour after hour at Dien Bien Phu. In Geneva today, the Secretary of State, Mr. Dulles, called the Australian and New Zealand foreign ministers to a private meeting on the Indochina war. Dulles flies to Italy tomorrow, and he's going to discuss Trieste with the Italian premier there. And thereafter, he'll return to Washington for talks with the president and congressional leaders. Here at home, the Chicago Weather Bureau says the threat of tornadoes in Iowa and Illinois has ended. It says, too, the danger of new twisters has diminished somewhat in other areas. Earlier, the Bureau had warned of tornadoes threatening southern Wisconsin, central Missouri, central and southern Michigan, and the Southwest. Here are the baseball scores. The Yankees split with the Tigers. The Yanks won the first game 12-4. They lost the second 4-0 after five innings of darkness. Cleveland took two from Washington, the scores. First game, 6-4, and the second game, Cleveland 6, Washington 3. The Chicago White Sox and the A's split. Chicago took the opener, 4-0, lost the second game by a score of 2-1. Two games rained out for Baltimore and Boston. In the National League, the Phillies beat Cincinnati 4-3 in 10 innings, first game. The second game was called on account of wet grounds. Quite a bit of news made by Stan the Man Musial today. He got five home runs and a doubleheader. 3 in the first game, 2 in the second, and that is a record. The Cards beat the Giants 10-6 in that first game. In the nightcap, though, New York came back to win by a score of 9-7 over St. Louis. The Cubs beat the Pirates 5-3 in the first game. The second game, Pittsburgh 18, Chicago 10. That was an 8-inning game and called on account of darkness. Brooklyn and Milwaukee scheduled for a single game, but they were rained out. More cross-examination by Senator McCarthy is the prospect for Army Secretary Stevens when he resumes the witness stand tomorrow. McCarthy is expected to concentrate once more on the Secretary's contention that he didn't want to halt the Senate investigation at Fort Monmouth, but only end what Stevens has claimed was the misrepresentations made by the Senator about conditions at the radar laboratory. Republican cries that their party is being hurt by the McCarthy Army investigation continue. Leaders of the Republican Party say it should be cut short. There's this comment tonight from hearing Chairman Carl Mundt. He says the Senate has not found any workable formula to save time by avoiding side issues or by reducing questions asked of witnesses. And Senator McCarthy reiterates that the investigation is a great waste of time, but now that it's going, he says, the senators should go along with it. By the way, the Democratic Senator Edward Johnson of Colorado says the way he sees the McCarthy Army investigation, they're all lying at the hearings. The Colorado senator calls the whole affair repulsive. And that's the news up to this moment.
Thank you, Jim. And that was Jim Fleming with all the current words. And this is Dave Garraway again with my exclusive predictions of things to come. And some rather fine items will be coming along 1 week from tonight right here. Item like Arthur Schwartz, the composer, who is now celebrating his 25th show business anniversary. And another gentleman who is marking up a quarter century of the good life. His name is Mr. Pat Kelly. Pat Kelly was the man who turned radio announcers into acceptable citizens, or a reasonable facsimile thereof, and you can't have everything, as you know. But we'll have as much as we can get in, transcribed, and there'll be welcome hinges on the door. And until then, this is Dave Garraway with a drive gently and a good night and peace.
This was Sunday with Garraway. Tonight, listen to Inheritance on the NBC Radio Network.